From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. LA's restaurant scene is booming with new openings, but how do all these places survive? Well, the truth is that some do and some don't. This week, we're revisiting a show on the subject that first aired in July. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food. The restaurant business is seductive. Where else can a person passionate about food channel their inner craftsperson along with a bit of mom and a bit of a pirate? But it's hard, so hard to survive. A decade ago, Ohio State University researchers found 6 out of 10 restaurants fail in the first year. In the Western U.S., more recent findings reveal that the median lifespan of a restaurant is just 4.5 years. My own place lasted 27 years, but man, so hard.
I mean, hill and dale, you're climbing hills all the time. And you think, is there something on the other side of the hill? Like, you're going to eventually get to this pot of gold, and somewhere around maybe a quarter way in it, you say, this is an impossible situation.
That's Vincent Williams, the owner of Honey's Kettle in Culver City, California. He's one of the 5 chefs and restaurateurs we're talking to about sustainability in the restaurant business for this week's show.
And you know what keeps you going is that you have to believe that the impossible could be turned to possible, because that's what restaurateurs are doing a lot of times.
Vincent, you've been frying chicken for more than 40 years. But your first job in the business wasn't in restaurants. You worked the graveyard shift in a packing house, didn't you?
Actually, to kind of correct that a little bit, it was for a restaurant, the packing house. And so my job was to stand in about 3 feet of ice and pack these chickens and get them prepared for the restaurants that we were serving.
What restaurants were they?
The Golden Bird Restaurant, the famous Golden Bird from the 1950s.
So many people love that chicken.
Oh, it was an amazing story there. I mean, you know, he was a contemporary of Colonel Harlan Sanders. He could have been probably bigger than Colonel Harlan Sanders.
I think so,
this
too.
This man knew everything about chicken there was to know. And I was his understudy. From the day I met him, I basically saluted him and said, Mr. Stennis, I will carry out the job that you assigned me to.
That's just so awesome, that kind of commitment. And you had that job for a long time.
Well, let me just go back. It was about 5 years into the job, I got promoted into the warehouse manager position. And that's when I met the famous Willie J. Stennis. He told me, he said, son, you have a critical job. And I looked back and said, sir, I will carry that job out no matter what it takes. So even today, I can attribute that salute to him, that no matter what, I would endure and I would prevail eventually.
And this business requires that one endures. So let's talk about this voyage you took. You converted the original Golden Bird in Compton, 1999, into Honey's Kettle. How did you get that Golden Bird?
Well, in 1983, the Golden Bird Company wanted to start franchising, and they offered me an opportunity to be the guinea pig. So they said, you take this failed location, give us some money down, see what you can do with it.
So you'd been with the company for
10 years at that point.
For 10 years, and they're giving you this incredible entrepreneurial opportunity.
Yeah, it certainly was. And I, during that time, I only looked at it as an incredible opportunity. And it was a dream that, you know, I just wanted to hang on to. No matter how tough it got, it's like the dream of owning a business and the possibility of doing something with it was, you know, what my pursuit was. And I remember one time it got so hard. It was like, it was impossible. And I went to him and I said, hey, you know, I mean, the money going out is running so much faster than the money coming in. How am I going to make this work? And he said, son, you're working for yourself. And it's like, whatever it takes, you got to do what you got to do. And that's what I did.
Instead of ever walking away, you took it and you changed it into something else.
Yeah. In 1999, Mr. Stennis had passed in 93. And in 1999, the company was really finding it hard to make it. they got in a lot of trouble, and they sold the name. When they sold the names, the new people came in, and I decided that with all the experience I had, that I could create my own concept. And so from that point on, I spent about 10 months in the conversion process, lost 50% of the little sales that I had, but I was determined to take the time, do the research. I went down to the Central Library in Los Angeles and did research on colonial America and how they used to cook in the fireplaces and stuff like that. And I said, I want to come out with something that people would identify as a truly American product. It was like putting pieces in a puzzle. The first piece didn't show anything, second piece, but by a certain amount of time, I started seeing an image. And as I kept putting it in, the concept kept expanding and it evolved. That's how I am where I am today.
In Compton, Honey's Kettle, were you getting the same customers that you had when it was the Golden Bird?
Actually, when I took the sign down and disassociated with the Golden Bird, people just passed me by. The area where I was doing business was sort of a desolate area. There was no real economic activity. And everyone who came there knew we were there, and they would drive. But once the sign went down, they would drive and say, what is this now? I'm not stopping. And so we lost that 50% of the business. But some people kept coming. And gradually, as I was working on testing the product, and I mean, I'm talking about testing and throwing away, because I needed to have something comparable to what I had before. So as I tested and retested, I kind of became a self-taught product developer.
What were you looking for in the chicken itself?
I'll tell you something. I went back and raked through my whole experience with eating chicken, from the times when my mother and my sister used to make it for dinner for the family. And there was about three times that really stood out to me. And I was seeking to capture that taste. One time, it was one of my mother's friends, and the girl had like a single piece of breast that she shared with me. And I mean, I was a youngster at this time, and I just remember it being like the most tasty chicken I had ever had. Then there were some experiences I had in the 70s with the Golden Bird, where I had like a piece of chicken that just was like, wow, this is incredible. And so in raking back, I was trying to figure out how to capture that taste.
You're looking for a moist, flavorful interior, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what is the exterior?
The kettle process, which we named it, was about dropping it in a very deep vat of oil. And as soon as the wet batter goes into the oil, it locks at the bottom of the kettle, and then it immediately forms a crackling outer shell. And so all the natural flavor of the chicken is maintained on the inside of that shell. And so by the time it's done, it comes out and it just, you know, has a delightful color and the flavors are just intense. I've been doing this recipe for, 35 years or so. And maybe a month ago, I finally left it alone and said, this is it. I'm not messing with it anymore. And it was by trying to get those combinations of flavors. Because, you know, in every layer of producing a product, there's a flavor profile. Say you cheapen the fifth layer. That fifth layer may overcome the other four. So in every layer of flavor, I was trying to enhance, not to take away from the chicken, but enhance the natural flavor of the chicken.
That kind of commitment is just insane. The business is so hard. And to have that level of intellectual engagement with your product for so long, that is a rare thing.
Well, you know, my response to that, I went in the business without the proper toolkit. And proper toolkit being credit and banking relationships and capital. The proper tools are good record keeping. All the things that are the hallmark of why people go out of business. I went with a toolkit. It was like a mechanic going to work without a wrench. A carpenter going to work without a hammer. So I'm going to work without any of these tools. But I found out that as the storms began to come, I needed to double down on the product. And at every turn, double down on the product. Now, I didn't have any money to work with, so it's like, what else do I have? The product. Because eventually, it will be the product that will prevail. the people will be my vocal cords.
So most people who are listening to this are going to know the name Honey's Kettle from your place in Culver City.
That's correct.
How did that opportunity come to be?
You know, it's an amazing thing. You know, they talk about karma, they talk about destiny, and all these kinds of things that you hear about, that if I can trust you in little, then I can trust you in a lot. So as I was shining that dusty old car down there in Compton, basically in the vineyard operating, it was like the only reward I really got was this new location. I got a chance to come to Main Street USA and show what I had learned. And so that's how it came about. I think it just was an exchange of investing and stewarding and working hard and getting absolutely nowhere that finally an opportunity came to do something with it.
So you arrive in, as you say, Main Street USA. The people love you.
Mm-hmm.
Business is good.
Mm-hmm.
And then another hill.
Oh, this was like the final blow. I got a lot of times to the end of the end of the end. You know what I'm talking about. You get to the end of the end of the end. You say, I'm out of money. I can't call Aunt so-and-so. I cannot do this anymore. This is it. We're out of this business. So I finally get this opportunity to go into Culver City. And 4 months into it, we have an equipment failure that leads to a fire. The place gets destroyed. And I walked in that morning and I just hit the floor. And for about 3 hours, I was just on the floor saying, how could this happen to me? How could a man work so hard, finally get an opportunity to do something with it, and then a fire knocks him down? But fortunately, Farmers Insurance put a plug in for them. They didn't think that it was fraud, and they came in and they helped me get back on my feet to an extent. But by that time, I had like dove even deeper into debt, like an impossible situation to get out of. Most people probably, I guess, would walk away from it, but what are you going to walk away to?
Yeah.
Are you going to get an unemployment check? They don't give unemployment checks to business owners.
Most people don't know that. No unemployment check.
and
disability.
And then those debts, they don't go away.
No, they don't.
Now they're coming at you at home.
But you still had that Compton store.
I kept the Compton store. It was sort of like a security blanket. The arithmetic in the Compton store, I just played games with myself on it. That store was never going to make any money. It was in a desolate area. There was only so much volume. The demographics were not right. But it was the only thing I had had, so I just held on to it and held on to it too long. And then finally, they started putting pressure on me over there. And they said, well, you know, we've been letting you slide. You know, you haven't been missing rent payments here. And at that point, I said, you know, I'm not going to try to borrow any money and sink any more money in it. So I closed it to focus on Culver City. And that was the turnaround, is when Compton finally closed.
And you came back in Culver City.
Oh, did I come back? Oh, my goodness. You know, I brought a lady named Tao Atua, who's been with me for like 32 years or so. And she's my sergeant in arms. And I brought her and a couple of people from Compton. And we went to work in Culver City and we were trying to bang it out. You know, every day I get up, I'm thinking about, well, how can I make this place better than it was yesterday? And by banging it out, all of a sudden, it was like water started coming in the room. And the water's gotten to the point where, you know, we got a little water now. And I have a toolkit now. I actually have the tools of business after all this time. So that's a testimony to the hope and the dream of it all, that it could happen.
In all this time that you've been working, pushing the rock uphill, did you ever want to say, chicken, you haven't been good to me?
No, I never thought about that. It's kind of like you get on to something and, you know, this is the product that you know, to switch gears and go into another product that I've never done before would be like starting all over again.
And I'm curious, these days, now that there's water in the room, what are some consistent challenges that you just see that are just endemic to the business?
You know, every day you wake up, it's a different day in the restaurant business. I mean, there is just enormous amount of variables that you're dealing with all the time. Employee retention is a very difficult problem. You've got, you know, the taxing agencies that demand so much of you. You've got the regulators. They all demand so much of you. You've got your customers who demand so much of you. And something you can do, you make a mistake, it could be a single mistake and it could be fatal. If you don't adapt to the ever-changing environment in business, you could find yourself with longer odds than you had when you first started.
Tell me what you think of the grading system that restaurants operate under currently in L.A. County.
In order to talk about that, you have to go to the origins of it. There was a crack reporter that went to some restaurants and took some photographs of real huge problems, problems that should have shut those people down, and I'm sure they got shut down. I think it was such an embarrassment to the county system, to the inspectors, to the county supervisors. How did this happen? We've got to stop it. And so as a result, they came up with the system of grading. They allow the cities to decide whether they want to put grades or not. But when you think about it, this person who has all the capital in the world that you need and all the labor that you need is going to have invariably an unfair situation compared to the guy in an old building with huge maintenance problems. And at any moment in time when they come in, you know, they might find four or five things, or they might find 50 things, because we live in an imperfect world. Food grows in the dirt. The system of grading came about, and this is the unintentional consequences, is what it winds up doing. It says that anybody less than an A, this is a dangerous place to eat in. People don't look any further than that grade a lot of times. And I don't know if that's a really good way to determine. They've always had the power to shut you down. If they send you down there to that chief inspector, he's going to give you a certain amount of time to correct your problems, and then he's going to put you out of business. So, you know, the wise people know you can't operate a business. And the customers will tell you finally in the final analysis, they're going to be the ones who really tell you. They're going to come in maybe one time and say, oh, no, I'm not going back there again. So this grading system has been very interesting. Some cities haven't adopted it. Take Pasadena, California, for example. I'd like to know what the thinking is behind Pasadena saying, well, I don't know if we want to advertise grades, because a grade is not based on like an A minus, you know, which you might be very happy to get, or a B plus. It's either an A or cut and dry B. And B is announcing to the public, stay out of here, there could be a problem.
Vincent Williams is the owner of Honey's Kettle in Culver City, California. Density and competition are big struggles for new restaurateurs in cities like LA. Our next guest clues us into how she found a niche in Koreatown. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
It's not easy to open up a new place. It's not easy to open up a new concept. You know, we had so many moments of wanting to close down. We really considered it. You wouldn't even imagine. We considered it so many times, but we were just like, all right, just keep trying and keep trying.
7 years ago, the Kwan family opened a bar and restaurant in Koreatown called Beer Garden. A year after it opened, Ann Kwan took over running the business. So when Beer Garden first opened, you weren't involved.
No, I was not.
So you get this call out of the blue. From who?
My older brother.
Who started it?
Yes.
And he's like, I'm out of here.
Kind of. It happened to be so that he had to move to New York. He had just gotten married and my sister-in-law had to relocate out there. So he had to move. And therefore, since it was a family restaurant, I was the next in line. And therefore, yeah, that's when I started running Beer Garden.
I know your parents have been in the restaurant business for a long time.
Yes, for decades.
Was this sort of your brother was on point here and your parents were helping?
Yeah, definitely. If anything, my parents were just the financial backings to what my brother had in mind. And so he had the concept of bringing this European beer garden to Koreatown, which was, there was nothing like that before. I think my mom and dad had definitely fully backed his ideas and made his concept come to life.
Which is pretty amazing, because one would imagine that would kind of be a hard sell.
Definitely. Definitely. When we were first starting, it was really hard to get it out there, to be honest, yes.
So just to give us an idea of the flavor, so to speak, of the place, I would imagine there are a lot of different German beers on tap, or German-style beers.
Yes.
Which is very, very different from a lot that's going on in, like, the craft beer movement these days.
Because
the beers have a different flavor profile.
Definitely.
What were some of the dishes on the menu that people would just come back for over and over again?
Right now, it would be our German fried rice, which is actually sausages, German bratwurst. We take that and sauerkraut, add a little bit of soy sauce, a little bit of like sriracha sauce, stir it up, make it into fried rice, top it with an egg and some gravy.
It's sort of like kimchi fried rice.
Yes.
But not.
Exactly. Because, I mean, sauerkraut is the German, quote unquote, kimchi, as they would say.
But so, it's really interesting that it's like not spicy.
Yeah, it's actually not spicy. Exactly.
Perfect drinking food.
It is. It is.
So we should say that when you took over this restaurant, you were in your 20s.
Yes, I was actually 20 when I started. Yeah.
Did you have different dreams and hopes?
I did. I definitely did.
Were you hoping to break the bonds of the family restaurant business?
It was more of a fallback, I thought. I was assuming that my parents would one day be retiring, and maybe around then, I was like, all right, let's try it then. But yeah, it happened a lot sooner. It's still a struggle, and it's a daily grind, but I'm getting better at it. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing about the business is getting into the rhythm of knowing that every day is going to be a grind.
Yeah, I gotta say that was the 20 midlife crisis kind of thing, like just learning that and just kind of accepting that for what it was.
As opposed to waiting, thinking that you're going to get to a place where the days are really easy.
Yeah, I can't help it. I think that's a millennial mindset.
I think that's a regular person who isn't in the restaurant business mindset.
Yeah, I gotta say, I did understand that there was a lot of behind-the-scene works of running a business, but I was never very involved. Like, I was very fortunate where my parents did provide me my college education, and they were pretty good about, you know, just having me focus on my studies and, you know, having
me
focus.
You were sheltered.
Yeah, definitely.
And then they threw you into the fire.
Pretty much, yeah. They, I mean, you know, things happened. They needed me, and therefore, you know, I was like, all right, I'm part of the family. This is my portion I had to take care of, so.
You've been the point person at Beer Garden for about 6 years, right?
Yes.
Over that 6 years, it's really come into its own a lot more.
Yes.
So to what do you attribute the success?
I gotta say, well, I mean, there are a lot of different points where we transitioned many times. We were still struggling to find our identity from the beginning. When I first started 6 years ago, we were still like, are we a Korean bar? Are we still like a German bar? We had the concept of a Korean-German bar, but we really couldn't find an in-between. I think over the years, what really kept us still like going was kind of the sport. Like, Lakers were doing really well back then with Kobe before he retired. That kind of was steady every year. So with that, we were able to have people come back. But over the years, we started experimenting more with our food, and we had got a different chef at that point. He really wanted to do something different here in Koreatown, and he had a really extensive background in just really working under really big-name chefs.
This is Eddie Ha.
This is Eddie Ha, Edward Ha, yes. And he's the one that came up with the whole German fried rice idea, which, I'm not going to lie, I thought that was very eclectic at first. I was like, what is this, you know?
But yeah, I mean, he was on Guy Fieri's show, right?
Yeah.
Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
Yes. He was our main chef. And then my brother, you can see my brother on the episode. I come out for like 2 seconds in the background.
And and so there's a dish that's featured in that episode that's a drunken chicken.
Yes. It is oven roasted. We brine it over for 24 hours with herbs and beer, obviously, and then cook it to order.
It's a beer can chicken.
It is.
You know what I loved about that segment is that you could see Guy Fieri sort of just going along. It's just a regular thing. You've seen it a million times before.
Right.
And then it comes out of the oven and it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Like super lacquered. And then he bites into it and he's blown away.
And he was. How we knew that was because even off camera, he was really just complimenting our chef. He's like, wow, this is amazing. And that's when I really knew he really meant it.
So in this dance that you're trying to do of figuring out the identity of being a Korean bar or a German bar, what does that mean?
A Korean bar, you know, even alcohol, it's mostly based around soju, a rice wine kind of thing. And a lot of the dishes would be traditional Korean dishes, a lot of spicy foods, stews and whatnot. And burgers wouldn't be on the menu, for example. Of course, chicken would be, but the flavor profiling is very different, I think.
And the hours. Korean bars are like famously like super late night places, right?
True. Yes. In Korea, there definitely isn't a cutoff time. You just drink till the morning and it's normal.
The smash-up is so eclectic. Are the people who come a pretty eclectic group as well?
Oh, definitely. Our customer base did change over the years with our different menu items. As our menu transitioned, so did our people, I think.
Did that scare you?
It did, honestly. At one point, we wiped off almost like half of the things on our menu.
The Korean.
Yeah, even the Korean ones. Like, because we were still experimenting. Like, before, we had peanut butter sliders on the menu, which is not Korean or German. But, you know, we were just trying things like that. And believe it or not, that was a big hit. And, like, when we just took items off like that or, like, altered our recipes, our customer bases did change. That was scary. But what happened was, I think, over the years, like, people that were familiar with us from the beginning, you know, they started coming back and were like, oh, like, you know, you guys kind of changed it up and whatnot. But over the years, like with, you know, the Food Network and all this other press that we were getting, we actually got more families coming in. Now we have like a set of families with their grandparents and their children coming in. The other day, like a father comes in with his little girl and she's eating ice cream and he's like having beer, just watching sports. And I have another regular, and they're an old retired couple, but they tell me about their travels now all over the world. It's, like, amazing, like, the spectrum of people. It's so diverse that I get surprised myself a lot.
Do Germans come in for German sporting events?
Oh, yes. This past, I believe it was a soccer championship. I cannot remember the exact one, but we had a group of people in their German jerseys, and they were just, like, rooting for the games. And once again, I was like, wow, I didn't know that there were German people living in Koreatown.
So since you've managed to stick it out and be around, have some of the original Korean customers come back?
Yes. I don't even think you would see them at any other like restaurant that's not Korean in Koreatown, but they come to Beer Garden because they feel comfortable enough. Like, we were fortunate enough to be featured on another Korean radio show. And I think that's kind of helped us kind of get our name out to even the Koreans living in Koreatown.
So I'm curious, knowing what you know now, when you got that phone call, would you have said, nah, find somebody else?
I'm not going to lie. I'm probably going to feel a little compelled to do so. But I have to say the hard work is very rewarding. So if you ask me if I would do it again, I probably would.
That's Ann Kwan. She owns and runs Beer Garden in Koreatown in L.A. Now, let's travel from Koreatown to Little Tokyo. That's where Sean Pham opened up his restaurant, Symbol, in 2015. Hi, Sean.
Hello, Evan. Happy to be here.
I'm sorry it's because of this, I have to say.
It's unfortunate, yes.
Before we get into why you closed, tell us a bit about the restaurant. What was the space like? What was the menu?
The name of the restaurant was Symbol Restaurant. It was in Little Tokyo in downtown Los Angeles. The food was Southeast Asian, so it was Thai and Vietnamese influenced. The space was actually quite large, about 3,200 square feet, which is considerable. But downtown LA at that time had very reasonable rents, and that's what attracted us there. The style of food was, I wouldn't say very casual, very high-end, but kind of somewhat in the middle.
So your professional training in cooking is actually French, Italian, Spanish, American food. You worked for the Bettina Restaurant Group. You worked at Sona, Kraft, and the Bazaar for 7 years. Then you studied food in Vietnam for 4 years. Did you go to school or did you avail yourself of family?
So I'm Vietnamese by birth. My parents are both Vietnamese, but I was born in America. So what that means is that I was limited to my exposure of Vietnamese food and culture. So I got to a point in my career where I realized I have certain kind of techniques and fundamentals down, but not in my cultural heritage. And I felt that in order to learn the most I can, I need to immerse myself. And by living in the country, that's the best way to do it.
So Simbol was actually the first time that you cooked Asian food professionally.
Yes. Not a lot of people know that, but that is the truth.
So I'm really curious about this whole discussion that people are having about how hard it is to get a certain price for a kind of considered Asian food made by skilled cooks who have been exposed to a more classical level of training, let's say, than other kinds of food, at least here in LA. Do you think that it's a harder sell to get a certain amount of money for Asian food?
Asian food, yes, in particular, but any type of ethnic food for various reasons. And I think that whether people realize it or not, everyone has an innate food bias. Let's say you're walking down the street and you saw two taco vendors selling street tacos next to each other. One was Hispanic and one was white. Which one would you rather go to? The exact same food, exact same price. Most people would probably say the Mexican. But you don't know. Maybe the white guy's been making tacos for 20 years and that's the first day the Hispanic guy is. That's just kind of like innate bias. I have that to myself. I'm not going to say I don't.
Yeah, I think a lot of us do. The restaurant, Simbol, was a family endeavor, wasn't it?
Correct, it was, with my parents.
Do you think some of the decisions that you made together as a family were different than decisions that you would have made if you had been able to do it on your own?
Of course. They're very, very influential in the decision-making process. But at the same time, I don't think that I would be able to put the blame on anyone. I think we accept full responsibility for it. No one made us do anything unwillingly. We willingly made all the decisions ourselves. So, you know, it comes along with the territory. You have to accept the high risk of the nature of the business.
So I remember when Jonathan Gold reviewed your restaurant, he loved the food and he talked very highly about the food. But before he got to the food, he talked about, in a funny way, the experience of getting inside the restaurant. Do you think that the decision to locate the restaurant where you did in Little Tokyo had an impact?
Without a doubt, it did. But that was, out of all the factors that led to the restaurant closing, the hardest one to change. We can change the service, the price, the dishes, the music, all these different things, but the location was the hardest thing to change. But that being said, we looked at other restaurants in LA that have challenging locations, and sometimes that adds to it. People like the lure of hard-to-find places.
That's true. So what are the biggest challenges to open a restaurant in a major metropolitan area like Los Angeles?
Without a doubt, the biggest obstacle is the financing, investment, and the cost. It's so incredibly expensive to negotiate a lease, pay for the construction, the staff, the inventory, the food, the wine, the furniture, the fixtures, all these things that come in that are part of opening up a restaurant. But then people will come in and say, why does this cost this much? I can get this much somewhere else.
Okay, so your restaurant cost in excess of $1 million to open.
Yes.
And people would walk in, they would, in their minds, think it was a Vietnamese restaurant.
Yes.
And they wanted to eat a bowl of pho.
Yeah. A normal scenario would be people would come in. I don't know if they found us on Yelp, but they would ask for pho, and then we would say, I'm sorry, we don't have that, but we have other dishes, and they would just get up and leave.
To me, this is, like, insane. I mean, you have found a place to park. Or even if you walked from work, you've spent your 20 minutes getting yourself to this restaurant. Why would you leave? People are so odd.
I think humans have this nature where we want what's familiar. Anytime you go and eat something that you've never had before, you risk being let down or not enjoying the food or the experience. So people are more likely to play it safe. That's why some people, even regulars that go to some restaurants for 20 years, they still order the same dishes.
Yes, they do.
I don't know. I think people don't want to take that risk of trying something new sometimes.
So that dance of you trying to, in the first months, stake out your territory and show people who maybe didn't come to you from Eater, that maybe they weren't, quote, foodies, so they were less familiar with what you were going to offer them. How did you do that dance of seduction to try and get them to stay and try something else?
We tried to structure the menu in a way where the prices are reasonable, the portion sizes were comparable to the portion sizes and the price, and we try to offer value. So at the very least, if you're unfamiliar, the menu is in plain English, so there's no fancy words where you feel uncomfortable asking the server, what's this, what's that? Everything should be pretty straightforward. I purposely removed all these words because I don't think it makes people feel comfortable. We had a set menu where it was $39 for three courses, including dessert. And then after tax and everything, you're looking at about $45 a person. And some people, that might seem like a lot, but at the same time, that's the same amount of money you would spend if you went to a chain. If you went to Cheesecake Factory or Applebee's, spending that much for three courses for a person adds up to that much. So in my mind, I'm thinking I'm offering you something different and unique and value at the same time.
You know, so much has been written about no-shows in Los Angeles, people who make reservations. Maybe they make reservations at several different restaurants for the same evening, and then they never bother to cancel. Did that have an effect on you as well?
Absolutely, without a doubt. We had a pretty high cancellation rate. Industry average is about 30%. And what usually happens is that you have a 30% walk-in percentage that compensates for that, and it usually works out. If the cancellation rate goes up and the walk-in rate goes down or fluctuates, then you're in a tight situation. We had many nights where we had 100% cancellation rate, to the point where I would look at that and I wouldn't even flinch. But here's the thing, there's nothing I can do about it. And what people don't understand or realize is that when you make a reservation, a restaurant has to staff accordingly. They have to order the food. They have to prep. And then when you don't show up or you cancel at the last minute, that has a big effect on the restaurant. That's like if I made a lunch appointment with you and I just didn't show up, you'd be sitting there thinking, like, why didn't you just call me and tell me that you're not coming? And it's the same thing with sporting events or theater tickets. You just can't say, hey, I'm not going to come and give you my money back. Like, they're going to say, too bad. We set this seat aside for you, and that's that.
Yeah, the public really needs to be educated on that. So now the family made the decision to close. I can't imagine how hard that must have been. I understand that your mom has gone back to work and your parents are considering selling their house. It's really affected the family deeply.
Yes, it has. There's no way around that, but it's part of the risk involved in opening up a restaurant. It was our first restaurant, and we learned a lot along the way.
Would you ever do it again?
It's a possibility, but in order for a restaurant to work, I'm sure you know, is that a lot of things have to be in place. Wanting to do a restaurant is one thing, but having a good location, having a good landlord, having a good lease, having a good business partner, having good investors and staff, all those things have to fall into place.
Yeah. So you would only do it if everything aligned. Are you going to look for work as a chef in other people's places right now? Or are you sort of burnt out on the whole idea of cooking?
No, I love cooking. Food is a passion of mine. I've invested the majority of my adult life into food. So I would like to stay in the industry one way or another. In what form, I'm not too sure at this point.
The takeaway in terms of what you think is sort of a better template, is it to not look for the 3,200 square foot place? Is it just open tiny?
That's a very good question. I think that a different model would make the city more interesting in terms of food. Restaurants, as we have already discussed, require such a high capital investment. So not a lot of people have access to that money. In order to have a big restaurant and do a lot of numbers, which investors want to see, you have to have a certain amount of appeal. So in order to fill up a 100-seat restaurant, you have to appeal to a certain amount of people and charge a certain price. what that means is that your food has to have mass appeal. You're limited in terms of how interesting or what you can do with your food. I think that doesn't make the food landscape better for Los Angeles. I think it makes it safer. For example, a few restaurants that I think that are small, that do interesting food, would be Baru or Destroyer, Rice Bar, Squirrel, Kato. But these are all small restaurants, and they're kind of able to pull the funds together themselves. What would be interesting is if there was a restaurant group that looked for these type of projects to partner with chefs. And here's the thing, restaurants have a high failure rate. If they kept the investment low and they factored in that failure rate and they opened up X amount of restaurants and some of them failed, they'd be okay with it because we expect some to work and some not to work. I think that would improve the food scene in Los Angeles. It would make it very, very unique.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for coming by and talking about some stuff that is fairly fresh and a little painful.
You're welcome.
You can learn about what Sean Pham's been up to since he closed Symbol on our blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we take a breather from our discussion on sustainability to get a restaurant review from Jonathan Gold. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. And now it's time for our weekly restaurant review from LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold. So, Jonathan, where are we headed this week?
The Ponte.
That's in the old Turin space in Beverly Grove?
It is.
And who is the chef of record?
The chef of record, though it must be admitted I've never actually seen him there, is Scott Conant.
So we're talking about that amazing plate of spaghetti with tomato sauce.
It is funny that a chef who's had at least a 20-year career in the United States and has had all the usual accolades is best known for a plate of spaghetti with tomato sauce, but there you have it.
I remember he was coming to the show once, and I was interviewing him on the occasion of a cookbook that he had published, and I went to have that sauce when Scarpetta was still open in L.A., and I was quite skeptical, of course. And it blew me away. I almost ordered it again as soon as I finished.
And a lot of people think of it as the $24 plate of spaghetti and tomato sauce. Though at the Ponte, it's $22 plate of spaghetti and tomato sauce. So I suppose that's progress for mankind. It's a well-cooked, slightly al dente strand of pasta. Almost everybody will make a tomato sauce, I think, from canned tomatoes because the consistency is so much better. But I think even at times of year, unlike this one, where tomatoes aren't so great, he'll use fresh tomatoes and just like a little bit of can in order to have the consistency be there. It's cooked down nicely. The flavor of the basil is really forward. And I think that's because he just folds in a little basil oil at the end, right?
I think so. When I've watched them from the perch near the kitchen, it seems that they have basil oil in a squirt bottle.
It's finished as almost nobody would suggest, with a big slug of butter and Parmesan. And it's not like put on at table. It's part of the emulsion. It's finished in the pan.
Yeah, so good. So we're not just going to this restaurant for a plate of pasta, are we?
Well, you could. But there's grilled octopus. You can get a plate of meatballs. There's like yellowfin tartare. There's squash blossom pizza and a citrus and fennel salad. It's California food with that sort of Italian overlay.
To me, there's something very synchronous about this kind of food in that space.
It's a lovely space. It has one of the better patios in Los Angeles, you know, filled with trees and foliage and twinkling lights. And at Tureen and even at the couple places before, it was always like sort of a magical place to sit.
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about the Ponte in Beverly Grove. Well, thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Next, we're back to talk sustainability in the restaurant business. Don't turn that dial.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. How do you describe your food?
Well, first of all, I describe it as not my food, really. It's food that I've learned over, you know, several decades of traveling and eating and studying in Thailand and Southeast Asia. It's my take on specific things that I've learned over the years.
Andy Ricker's serving up his take on Thai food at six different Pak Pak restaurants. Until recently, one of them was in Los Angeles. The fact that Pak Pak doesn't exist anymore here in LA makes me very sad. How many restaurants do you have now?
Six, I believe. I think, yeah. So one in New York and five in Portland at the moment.
What do you think it is about the difference in the two cities or situations that allows you to have such tremendous success in Portland?
Well, I think for one thing, Portland doesn't have as much of a long and rich history of Southeast Asian food being available to the population. Though we do have a pretty, you know, large Southeast Asian, mostly Vietnamese population here now, and that situation is changing. Number two is really just comes down to logistics. We have a commissary kitchen here. And having a commissary kitchen for a multi-unit restaurant is a massive advantage. If three restaurants serve, say, the chicken wings, and you can cook them all in one spot and then drive them to the different locations and finish them at the location, instead of three different locations all needing the equipment, the labor, the raw materials that are get delivered to each individual location to do exactly the same thing, you can see how there's an economy of scale there.
Pak Pak's food was more expensive given the quality of the ingredients, benefits given to servers. Do you think that LA diners just weren't willing to pay for that because they're unaware of why it was more expensive?
I've tried to dissect this in a bunch of different ways. I think that, you know, we're in a part of the city that, you know, just hasn't seen the type of restaurant we are try to open in the scale that we tried to open. And, you know, Chinatown LA, which, you know, parenthetically was really the only place that I wanted to do business in LA, was also the one neighborhood in the whole city where I probably was the worst place for us to open doing what we do.
Why?
Well, you know, you're dealing with a restaurant scene there where quantity and price have ruled the dynamic for so long. You know, you go into any of the restaurants down there and you can really get a giant plate of food for $7 or $8. And I think that the average diner in the neighborhood is really looking for taste and a certain amount of comfort level with the price they're paying for that taste. And it's difficult, understandably, for somebody to walk in to Pak Pak and pay, you know, $15 for a bowl of khao soi, which is chicken noodle soup, when they can walk down the street to a, you know, a Vietnamese restaurant or a Chinese restaurant and order chicken noodle soup for half the price. You know, you don't want to go out and argue with people and say, look, you know, we press fresh coconut milk and we use Mary's natural chicken, and paying our cooks a living wage and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Because by saying that politically, it's a terrible thing to do, first of all, because you're inferring that other people aren't. And at the end of the day, people eat what they think tastes delicious. And if you're satisfied with a delicious dish that costs you $8, then I totally get it that eating one for $16 may be delicious, but you're going to have to think about the value there. I don't blame the customers. I don't blame the neighborhood. It was a bad business decision on my part to open in that part of the city.
Do you think any of the difficulty that you ran into had to do with you being a white guy cooking Thai food?
I think there's always a little bit of that going on. You know, you look at the culture of the food you're cooking, and if you're not a part of that culture, there's naturally going to be some suspicion around it. And in some cases, there's an assumption that there's a sort of cultural appropriation part of it. And that, too, is understandable. I totally get why people might think that. But I've been kind of faced with that the whole time I've been doing this. And I don't really know how to answer that in a quick and easy way, except for to just keep on doing, what I do and, try to be as respectful as I can to the culture and the cuisine.
Yeah. And it's complicated.
Very, very complicated. Yeah. I mean, if you want to look at it in a very pragmatic way, I've been, studying and cooking this food for 30 years. Does that mean that I'm not allowed to cook this stuff? By the same token, somebody might, come out of culinary school and cook for 5 years, and all of a sudden they're a chef doing Italian food, and they've never been to Italy in their life. Everybody's okay with that. But normally these arguments aren't about pragmatic things. They're much more emotional than that. They have to do with people's cultural identity, the idea that, somebody outside of the culture is profiting from some aspect of the culture. That's just a really, really difficult conversation.
Would you ever come back?
To LA?
Yeah.
I love LA. I mean, I really do. I was heartbroken that this didn't work out. And mostly, I love Chinatown. I love the people there. Outside of having a failing business there, my experience there was overwhelmingly positive. I loved living down there. I love the food scene in LA. And, given the right situation, yeah, I would consider coming back. But talking about restaurants in general right now, it's an extremely difficult time to be opening restaurants. And I think that until the whole dynamic between wage, inequality, that the problem with the cost of living compared to wages, it's a huge challenge to everybody. Until there's certain dynamics there that get worked out, it's a very, very unstable and scary business to get into. There's some huge disadvantages to doing business in a city where your center of operations is not. I think that if I were to come back, the sort of business atmosphere would have to be a little different. Either the operation that I have would have to be much, much bigger with more tentacles, I guess is the best way to put it. Or I'd have had to downsize and get out of Portland and come back to LA to just be there.
Andy Rickers, the chef owner of Pock Pock. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan.
Surviving, let alone thriving in the restaurant business, as we've heard, is not easy. Michael McCarty of Michael's in Santa Monica and in New York City has done it for decades. Michael's in Santa Monica opened when?
We built it in 78. We opened in the spring of 79.
And then New York?
1989 we opened.
You weathered a really bad recession in the 90s that lot of people don't ever remember or like to think about. And the cataclysmic one we had already 9 years ago.
Right.
What other challenges have almost brought you to your knees?
Well, that 92 recession, that started with the riots after the verdict of Rodney King. That sort of...
The riots, the earthquake,
Then you had the fire, then you had the earthquake, then you had the collapse of the aerospace industry, the collapse of the construction industry, and we ended it up with the chase of O.J. We did a variety of things to make it through that 2 year period. That was insane.
Yeah, really, really hard. Talk a little bit about how you face the different challenges that are unique to LA and Los Angeles. LA here, Michael's now, doesn't do lunch, do you?
No.
So you just have a dinner house.
Yes, we're dinner here. We never were open for breakfast like we are in New York City. As I say, people, 55th and 5th is a little different than 3rd and Wilshire. And we, even in the entire 33 years that we were open for lunch, it was really a pro bono program. We did it as a sense of advertising. Because Santa Monica, was more of like a residential suburb. It didn't really have a huge business community. It certainly didn't in those days. In fact, that's the reason why I waited 10 years for my location in New York City was because it was in a center of a business area that would provide lunch. And immediately as I was there, I realized that the generation that was beginning to populate my restaurant were ones that also were there in the morning. And so that's why we open for breakfast. But again, dinner Monday through Saturday. And in New York, it's Monday through Friday breakfast, Monday through Friday lunch, Monday through Saturday dinner.
So the last time we had you on, we talked about the whole tipping insanity.
Right.
How is that playing out for you and this push to the $15 minimum wage? And how much harder is that going to make the Santa Monica restaurant?
It's extremely costly. January of last year in New York, just because it happened very fast there, they have, first of all, they have a tip credit for the serving staff.
What does that mean?
Tip credit means is that if you have an employee that you know is making minimum wage, they have tip credits. So instead of having to pay them the minimum wage, let's say it was $10 an hour, they would be paid $5 an hour because they know that a waiter who's making $2 or $250 a shift is being paid the minimum wage. And that thought process is the correct thing. California is one of five or six states that do not offer a tip credit to restaurants for their waitstaff or their servers. And so therefore, and when you're in a city like Santa Monica, for example,
which raised the minimum wage to $12 an hour for front of the house.
Right. $12 an hour on July 1st for the front of the house. And to me, it's a very symbol, aside from it economically being horrendous, it's a misdirection of the funds. If the state of California or even the city of Santa Monica, but it really needs to be the state so that you do not compromise your ability to hire waitstaff, because they'll say, well, like I said, in the day of Beverly Hills, they enacted a no smoking law. Well, everybody went one block to the east to smoke in West Hollywood. So once they made it universal, then it was never an issue anymore. Those funds should be used for the back of the house. People that work twice as many hours usually in a day, they toil under much fiercer circumstances. And due to the economics of restaurants, it's virtually impossible to pay them any more than the $12, $13, $14, or $15 an hour. And so therefore, if the state of California enacted a tip credit, then those funds, those additional funds, could be utilized to supplement the incomes of the people in the kitchen. And that's what I would strive to work towards, is changing the tip pool laws and enacting a tip credit in the state of California.
Michael McCarty owns Michael's in Santa Monica and in New York. That's it for this week's show about the challenges of staying afloat in LA's restaurant business. It first aired in July. If you missed any part of the show or you want to listen again, you can go stream it on our website or use KCRW's mobile app. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, for instance. And a quick favor for you podcast listeners. KCRW wants to learn more about you, who you are, how you listen. So if you have 3 minutes to help us out, go to kcrw.com/survey. Thank you. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Rosalie Atkinson, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and once again, we'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.